Welcome to The Howl. Really excited to see you here. Thank you for tuning in. We're continuing our conversations with faculty, staff, and hopefully students coming up soon about what we have going on campus here in Alpine. This second episode this semester, we're talking with Dr. Bradley Carpenter. He's in his sophomore year of being the faculty here at Silross for the Education Department, being associate professor, and also being the chair for education. He has a really cool vibe. He was really easy to talk with during this episode. Really got into how he was brought up and some of his passions that he has. You can really tell the passion he has for students in the classroom, and it's really refreshing to kind of hear that. With Silross, we're very much an education school, and I'm really glad that he's sort of in the leadership there, leading the reins and sort of helping the department along, getting students here for undergraduate degrees, for graduate degrees, certificates and things. It's been really refreshing. He's also very active on social media. So as a social media coordinator for the university, yeah, I see him a lot. His name comes up a lot. He's sharing our things. He's liking, he's commenting. He's very active. And we talk a little bit about that. We also talk about his years in college. We talk about some other jobs that he had before he became a professor, some mentors that he had growing up, as well as his favorite teacher when he was a kid. It's just really refreshing to hear. And so I hope you get a lot out of this conversation with Dr. Bradley Carpenter. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with that interview.
Hi. My name is Mary, and I am one of the counselors here at Silross State University in our Counseling and Accessibility Services office. In our office, we offer individual counseling, group counseling, we set up accommodations for students with disabilities, and we serve as a campus contact for both on and off campus referrals and resources. If you find yourself in a bind and you're not sure where to go, step into our office, Ferguson Hall, room 112. We'll either have the answer or know where to send you. You have chosen to attend a relatively small university in a small West Texas town, and with that, a unique setting where we make it our business to look out for each other. Students here are encouraged to check in with classmates, neighbors, and acquaintances. It is this practice that sets us apart from other campuses and larger universities. It is not uncommon to have a student walk a student into the counseling office when concerned. If you are coming from a larger city, you might be accustomed to more programmed ways of responding and interacting. Out here, we make the time to pause, engage, and question. We hope that you find that this value is built into the fabric of our way of life. If you are a newcomer to West Texas, we welcome you to our region, and we hope that you too assimilate into our shared values of looking out for each other. Welcome to the last frontier. Welcome to the Counseling and Accessibility Services Office at Silross State University.
Welcome back to the show. I'm here with Dr. Bradley Carpenter. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me today.
Glad to have you. Been really anticipating having you on the podcast just because you're kind of a public figure. You're very active on social media, and you have a lot of stuff that's going on campus. And I think you're just one of those people that are very approachable, and I think people want to know more about you. So,
I appreciate that. I'm glad that that's the vibe that I'm giving off.
It's what that's what's exuding. But we're going to harness that. We're going to capture that and probably get into some background. So let's start from the beginning.
Sure.
So as far as coming into college, what were your interests starting up?
So as an undergraduate myself?
Sure, undergraduate or even senior in high school or pre-kinder.
Well, both of my parents were public education teachers.
Okay.
So I promised I would never go into public education.
Gotcha.
I wanted to go out into the real world and make money.
Yeah.
They weren't making a lot of money back then, and they still are not in some places, underpaid. So I went to college first to become an educational psychologist. I wanted to work with kids that were troubled or having difficulties. I came from a divorced family, so I saw the importance of therapy and psychology. And so I thought that would be a good profession for me. And then as I got into college and I really, you know, became more materialistic, I thought I need to make money. And I went into sales. And so my first job was with Nike. I wanted to be at the global campus in Beaverton, Oregon. And then I went to work for Ernest and Julio Gallo selling wine. And their global training program in Edmond, Oklahoma. And really was making good money, had a company car, and was miserable. You know, I'd always grown up around kids. I grew up around my parents in schools. I coached soccer. I played soccer in college. And just wasn't feeling connected to the community. I was traveling all the time. And so I called my father, who was an administrator in Belton, Texas, where I grew up. I said, I want to be a teacher. He's like, I knew it. They just didn't want to push me into it, thinking I'd rebel and be stubborn. And first day I was in the classroom, fell in love, and I've been in education ever since.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So what do you like about being in the classroom, being in front of students?
I think for me, it's, growing up with parents that were both public educators, I got to see the ripple effect of the people's lives that they influenced. And so we'd be at a grocery store or a football game or anywhere in town and have somebody, Mr. Carpenter, I love when you had me in government, it's 12th grade, and talking to my father and my mother who taught sophomore English. And so I got to see a real tangible effect that they had on the community that surrounded them. And for me, you know, I just grew up with that kind of chip on my shoulder, thinking that through education, we can change communities for the better. And you have that direct relationship with kids in the classroom, get to know them more about their lives and treat them as whole people as opposed to just numbers. And so I was able to see, you know, when kids came into my classroom, it was a safe space, were engaged in learning. They had an adult that they could trust. And no matter what was going on at home, they could come to school and have a good time and still learn with me. And so that was, for me, always the reward of being an educator.
And were there any like notable figures in your life, you know, your parents included, that sort of helped you through the good and the bad coming into education?
Yeah, I would say I always ask my students during the semester to name their favorite teacher, who was the most important teacher in their lives. And if they're still living, I require them, I give them extra credit if they'll email that person, just say thank you. Because so oftentimes we forget to reach back out. And I remember growing up, I was ADHD before ADHD was... ADHD was a diagnosis. And, you know, I'm older now. And so I was born in 73. So late 70s, early 80s, the type of schooling that we went through, or I went through, was sit at your desk, do your worksheets, and be quiet. Don't talk to your neighbors, do your worksheets. And I would do my worksheets and finish and want to be social, like talk to others or be engaged. I wanted to have my hands on stuff, be outside. And my fourth grade year, I qualified for our gifted and talented program, and we got to go to another school one day a week. And I had Miss Jane Hickerson, who just recently passed away. I did get to tell her how much she meant to me, though.
Oh, that's good.
And she opened up my eyes for education could be different. It could be project-based. We could get up and move around. We could do real-world problems. We could work as groups and collaborative groups. And so I thought, every kid deserves that type of learning, because I saw the kids like me, or the ones that were not learning, that were also getting in trouble, you know, just frustrated. And, you know, you spend so much time at school, you hate to see a kid that comes to school, you know, wanting to have relationships with adults and other kids be shut down because they're not performing in a specific way, in a specific box, or sitting at their desk. And so Jane Nickerson really changed my life. She was one of my role models in education.
Is there a specific moment that maybe you can recall? Maybe it's not the most meaningful, but maybe just the one that first immediately hits you that is the most remarkable with Mrs. Nickerson.
I think for me, and I need to make sure that on the podcast that we edit this, it's Hickerson.
Hickerson.
That's terrible that Nickerson.
It's okay.
Jane Hickerson. I would really be beating myself up.
I'll put like a little VO that just says Hickerson, and we'll just keep going.
Yeah, I think for, you know, we got to compete and develop commercials. And I thought, I mean, I was going from a classroom doing worksheets and sitting at a desk and being quiet to working with a group involving music, involving video at the time, creating our own sales pitches. And I mean, that was the type of an environment that I really excelled in. And so that was a moment for me. And there were kids from all different backgrounds. So they pulled from all the elementary schools across the district. And so these were kids, of course, our district, like a lot of Texas school districts, were segregated by economic status. And so I was in the classroom with kids that I never saw in my regular life. We were all put in the same groups of learning together. I thought that was really a fun moment for me.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I like that. As someone who's also afflicted with ADHD, that's, I mean, and, yeah. you know, our society is very much, sure. I mean, you can say for good or for bad, we're kind of hyper-fixated on this sort
right.
of thing. And me being ADHD, I'm hyper-fixated on it.
Right.
And so I'm doing as much research as I can.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like you were very much like an astute and like you're a student where you're able to like finish your work
yeah.
and then still have that drawing to be engaged sure. to reach others, which is really cool. What were some of your ways of being able to overcome maybe some of the negative aspects of ADHD?
You know, I think for me, athletics meant a lot to me. It gave me an opportunity to be outside, which I think all kids need to be outside and more. And it gave me an opportunity to work with others in a collaborative setting. And honestly, I know this sounds terrible, but in the late 70s, early 80s, we weren't doing group work in class. It was individual worksheet driven. And so working with a group, a diverse team, and getting to be physical and engaged in the environment, I think athletics for me really provided a solace from kind of being trapped under fluorescent lights and sitting behind a desk all day.
Sure. Yeah, totally get that. Yeah, mine was music. And, you know, I influenced me to a point where, you know, studied it in college here, actually, yeah. and something that still carries me as an adult person.
Right.
And, yeah, the having something to have an outlet for is definitely one of those things, yeah. Among countless other things. But that's really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So going into the field after you left yeah. Nike, after you're selling wine, which is really cool, being back in the classroom, where'd you start? Did you go to public education?
I went back to my hometown.
Okay.
And I taught fifth grade, having never taught or written a lesson plan before. So now there's a lot of alternative certification programs, and there were at the time, where you could go to a service center and get a quick certification. I chose to do it the hard way and go back to UMHB, University of Maryland Baylor, which was in my hometown,
yes.
and go through all the classes. But I really fell in love with education, probably my junior year of college.
Gotcha.
After I decided I wasn't going to be a professional soccer player.
Right.
The reality sunk in. And so I really got engaged in academics and, so it was fifth grade, and I still remember vividly that first day of walking into class, never having written a lesson plan, and having 28 kids. And I walked to one side of the room, and all 28 sets of eyes. Mm-hmm. I walked to the other side. I'm like, this is going to be a major responsibility. And so I've got to keep these kids engaged and fired up. Mm-hmm. And our school was overcrowded at the time, so I actually did not have a classroom. I was a cart teacher, so I had a little mobile cart. Uh-huh. With all my equipment, and I had six periods of the same class, and I would push my cart from one classroom to the next, set up really quickly, and work with my kids. But
wow,
found out what an amazing responsibility and opportunity it was to reach, I mean, 28 times six was approximately that many kids every day. Mm-hmm. And social studies was kind of that common thread that every kid had to take that class. It
right.
wasn't like advanced math or regular. It was everybody had to take social studies. So I got to see the broadest swath of kids at our intermediate school.
Mm-hmm.
And really that rewarding relationships with kids and getting to see them look forward to a class as opposed to grudgingly like coming to class.
Right.
I really immediately saw the powerful of positivity in teacher-student relationships, and that kind of led to my administrative career.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So paint me a picture.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing social studies was what you were teaching.
Yes.
What was in the cart?
I had, let's see, I had vis-a-vis markers. That was still when we had overhead projectors.
Yes. Oh, throwback, ladies and gentlemen. I love that.
I know I'm dating myself. That's now great. They're like, he is old. The audience would be, what's vis-a-vis?
I don't speak French.
Yeah. I had cardboard paper because the social studies teacher also had to do art. So that was a part of our curriculum. So I had colored paper. I had pencils. I had, you know, copies from the copy. I mean, we were handing out worksheets still. I had textbooks, trinkets. I had swag for the kids to give away for kids that were making good choices. And so just the kind of a grab bag of assortment of goods for any regular class.
Gotcha. So no wigs.
No wigs.
Richard Nixon mask that you just throw on.
I did do some acting. Like, I remember acting out some things in class and getting the kids to do a rap about colonization and, you know, some things that they hadn't done before. And they're like, this guy is different. Like, yeah, that was fun.
You wouldn't happen to remember that.
No, there's no recalling that rap at this moment.
Even if I like slipped a 20, you wouldn't be able to.
No amount of money. If you wouldn't have to pay me. If I remembered it, I would throw it down right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll trust you. I'm trust you. That sounds fantastic. Yeah. So, how many years did you spend? And
I was in the classroom for 3 years and really wanted to teach forever.
Yeah.
And because I had a good connection with the students, I was at a school where they were having a lot of discipline issues. It was an intermediate school. And my principal started paying me to work in my conference period to do discipline because she needed help with the amount of discipline. Even though they had two assistant principals.
Right.
And so I started working with the kids that came to the office, and that's when my mindset really changed of like, I'm going to be in education forever. I saw the power of a disciplinarian that really treated kids as a problem and looked at the deficit of what kids were coming into the office and what the power could be of an administrator that looked at kids as assets and the wealth that they brought into the office. And I also found out a lot of those kids that were in the office, it was an adult issue as opposed to a kid issue.
Right, right.
Impatience or lack of ability to, you know, differentiate instruction. Or again, like, well, we weren't in the 80s anymore, having kids sit at the desk all day under fluorescent lights and just expecting them to sit there and be quiet all day.
Right.
And so I really fell in love with doing discipline and became an assistant principal at a dual language elementary school and thought I would be an assistant principal for a long time. We just had our first kiddo and the superintendent came, saw that I was making a positive difference and asked me to apply for an elementary principal position. Mm-hmm. I said no. Mm-hmm. Said, we just had our first kid. I think I'm going to be an assistant principal for a while. And right after that happened, she offered me the job. 9/11 took place. Wow. And the principal that took the job at Sparta Elementary, where I eventually became a principal, was in the reserves, and he got called away.
Wow!
So she called me back and she said, "You're gonna be the principal."
Goodness gracious!
I said, yes,
no
ma'am.
Pressure.
Yes, yeah. Ma'am. Goodness. And so I started early. I was a principal at 28. I was early, but really had a positive experience at Sparta. Still keep in touch with a lot of the teachers and students that went through there. In fact, one of my students, currently Durham Smythe, plays football for the Miami Dolphins. I'm like, yeah, he was a Sparta. Uh-huh. And we did a great job as a community. I really brought the parents back into the school. They'd kind of been shut out for a while and made them a part of the decision-making in the community. We painted murals on the walls. We just kind of made it a more lively, accessible place. And our test scores really went through the roof. We became an exemplary campus, a Title I distinguished school. And my superintendent that hired me said, now I want you to go to UT Austin and get your EDD. You need to think about like superintendency in the future. You need to have this under your belt. And so I went to UT Austin and with the intent of getting my superintendent degree. And another one of my mentors, Dr. Jay Scribner, who passed away 2 years ago, grabbed me and said, we need people that have been principals to educate future principals. So get your PhD and go into higher education.
Wow. Okay.
Because a lot of education programs still in the United States, specifically ed leadership, don't have faculty all the time that have been actually a principal or an assistant principal. Mm-hmm. They may have ed policy scholars that have a lot to add on the research side, but they've never done the job of like a campus principal. Mm-hmm. And so I took his advice, and my superintendent's like, that's not why I sent you down there. I sent you to get your EDD.
Switched in.
I left to UT and became a graduate assistant. And after that, I've been in higher ed ever since. So I think I've been in higher ed for 13, 14 years now, and was in public education for 9 years.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. What a ride.
I know.
My gosh. You said something that I found really interesting, not to like backtrack.
Sure.
We're at a really good spot.
Yeah.
I love discipline.
Yeah.
Reducing it. Most people like that sort of knee jerk reaction. But I think just within the context of not the stern upper lip yardstick approach, but definitely getting to know the student you have in front of you. I just think that's really remarkable. And I think that's something that the field could grow into, just being able to have that emotional intelligence and that, you know, being able to have that empathy and to, you know, meet the student where they're at and to ensure their success rather than, you know, give some sort of negative mark towards a behavior, a temporary behavior.
No, I'm glad you recalled that, because I'm now picturing myself walking down the street with a shirt that says, I love discipline.
Yeah. In like people black like, letters.
Oh my gosh, what kind of guy is this? Okay. You know, if you think about it, it ties back to my desire to be an ed psychologist.
Right.
You know, because I treated the kids that came into the office as an opportunity to connect and to change lives as opposed to an opportunity to punish.
Right.
And take out of the classroom. So I wanted to get the kids back into the classroom. I wanted to find out what was in the root of whatever behavior. And like I said, a lot of times it was the adults that were triggering behaviors. And other times it was adults that were at home that were triggering behaviors that they were bringing with them to school. So I treated every student as an opportunity to make a positive difference. And the hardest part for me, and probably the good reason I didn't go into ed psychology, is I carried that all with me. I can still think of kids' names that I've tried so hard to keep in school and to keep out of the office, and just the stars were aligned against them, too many factors and variables against them, and you know, that I didn't get to capture all the way. But you know, I think I made a positive difference in a number of kids' lives.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
Thank you.
Well, I think going into higher ed is a good place to kind of take a little break from our ad dollars we got going on. But we'll be right back with Dr. Bradley Carpenter.
All right. That's greater plan. She trusts I'm a good man, and that's why I'll always believe. She's like Texas, and she likes me.
We're back with Dr. Bradley Carpenter.
All
right. So now we're going into your higher ed sort of career here. And let's go ahead and venture towards your time at Soros here. So you've been here, I want to say, 2 years.
This is my second year. I started July 10th, the previous July.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Time flies.
Before that, I was at Baylor University, the University of Houston, and the University of Louisville. So... And most people pronounce it Louisville, but if you're from Louisville, you say Louisville.
Sure.
It's just Louisville.
That's how you wean out the...
That's how you there. Know who the real Louisvillians are. So,
Louisvillians.
Yeah, I have enjoyed my time, and really my choice to come to Sol Ross, which is a lot of, you know, the work I do today, was I've been at Research One universities that the primary focus was on publishing and obtaining research grant dollars, which I think is important for our field because it pushes our field forward.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found at a lot of those research universities is they did not incentivize working with communities.
Right.
So if I wanted to do community service, or I wanted to go into schools and do free professional development, or I wanted to be out in the field and work with people, that wasn't incentivized in my evaluation. I could be a poor teacher. You know, I could not ever engage with the community, but if I got 3 publications a year and a grant, then I was going to get tenure.
Wow.
And so I decided, you know, early on that, you know, towards this part of my career, I wanted to find a university like Sol Ross. I graduated after I played soccer at Colorado Christian. I transferred back to Sam Houston State, and that's where I got my undergrad. Eat 'em up Cats, another... Not a really rival. We're a sister school.
So sister school.
We can love
friends.
Yeah, we're friends. Friendly rivals.
Yeah.
And so I decided I wanted to be, you know, at an institution like that, I saw so much elitism in higher ed. I went to UT Austin, and the national organizations that we were involved with, it was always Michigan, Wisconsin, UCLA. I mean, the same kind of blue blood, you know, elite schools. And so
gotcha.
I always had this chip on my shoulder, maybe coming from a small town and my parents not having a lot of money, that just because a kid goes to Texas Southern or Sam Houston or Stephen F. Austin or Sol Ross doesn't make them less than.
Right.
And I think a lot of these colleges do a bulk of work in terms of preparing teachers and educators and get little recognition or resources. Mm-hmm. And so I thought at this point in my career that I would spend whatever effort and energy I had left really lifting as much as I could one of these universities and working in these communities.
That's wonderful. Well, we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Because just the amount of exposure you give us and the amount of, you know, whenever we put out news.
Yeah.
I work with communications and marketing. Yeah, yeah. And so part of my job is kind of throwing that out there.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm the social media guy and I'll always see Bradley Carpenter shared your story, Bradley Carpenter reposted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you give a summary and you just give a lot of light. And,
yeah.
So as just the social media guy, I just want to say thank you for all that. If it's one like, it's your like, and I'm proud to say.
Well, you know, I think social media, you know, there's a lot of downfalls, of course. I just talked to my freshman about this yesterday and more engaged in the people in your lives as opposed to on your phone. But I will say for educators, social media is a big deal. I mean, I've cultivated my Twitter, I'm not going to say X, my Twitter audience over since I became really a graduate student, and my LinkedIn audience and my Facebook audience. And so I engage with other educators. And for us, it's a way to push out to show the rest of Texas and this region, like all the cool things that are happening here, because they're not going to hear about it in the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Right.
Or in sub-publication, you hear kind of the big names.
Right.
And I think people need to understand what regional universities like Sol Ross are doing to make a positive difference. So, yeah, I think it's an important part of what we do is telling our story and celebrating out loud. And it's something that I teach our students to do as well, is to grow their professional network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been fortunate that, you know, every year that I've taught graduate students, I've brought in people that I've met on social media and Zoom them into class, and people I've never met in person, but I know on social media, principals of the year in Massachusetts call them and talk to our class. So I think it opens up the world and gets them out of their little circle and kind of shows them that there are other hardworking adults in education that do the same thing they do and kind of appreciate all the work that they put into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. If it's not a doom scrolling thing, it's a great tool for connection, and that's wonderful. Really cool. So, as far as it pertains to education,
yes,
there's a lot that we offer here at Sol Ross. You know, it's ingrained in our history. It was one of the
former school.
Absolutely. And so it's just a tradition in and of itself, yeah, as well as a department. What can you talk about education today for undergrad and for graduate?
Yeah. So that's another reason that I wanted to come to Sol Ross is, you know, Sam Houston was a normal school as well. Right. So Sol Ross being an educator school, and I mean, if you follow me on social media, you'll know that I'm a big public education advocate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to stay nonpartisan, but, you know, we're dealing with difficult times in Texas in terms of PK-12 schools and funding. But at Sam Houston and Sol Ross, what the core of what we do is prepare future teachers and then future leaders. And the leaders could be future educational diagnosticians. It could be education counselors. It could be school principals, school superintendents. So everything from the top of the district, you know, down, if you're in a leadership position, there's a pathway for you at Sol Ross.
Right.
And on the undergraduate side, it's teaching, you know, EC6, 4-8, and then secondary in the high school. And so we really cover the entire pipeline of PK-12 education here at Sol Ross.
Yeah. Great. That's fantastic. Yeah. So as far as you said educational diagnostician,
counseling. We have an ed tech program too that Dr. Jennifer Miller, I know she's done some podcasts, she's in charge of.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. We have a leadership program where we're certifying future principals. Jennifer Hahn's been in charge of that. And then our superintendency program, Galen Privet. And as you know, we're about to launch the first ever Sol Ross doctoral program.
It's exciting. And that is, I don't know the full name. It's higher ed leadership is what it's called, something?
It's going to be educational leadership.
Okay.
And we're going to have two specific paths. So we'll have a higher education leadership track and a PK through 12 leadership track. The way that we've organized it, too, is around the theme of rural, borderland, and linguistically diverse communities, which no other university in Texas or in this region does.
It's fantastic.
We really think there's a niche for us because of where we're situated in the communities that we work with to build a curriculum that really prepares people for that specific context. So if you want to be a rural leader, you want to serve in a borderland school, or you're in a linguistically diverse community, it doesn't really matter if you're in Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, that you ought to come to Sol Ross and get your EDD, because we're going to build our curriculum out intentionally to prepare people for those contexts. And so our higher ed leadership program and our PK-12, they'll start taking classes together. We have a core where they'll learn the empirical research and theoretical research around a rural, borderland, and linguistically diverse communities. They'll take their methods classes together, quantitative, qualitative methods classes, and then they'll break out and to their expertise. So you'll break out into the higher ed section and you'll break out of the PK-12 section. And the PK-12 section will be embedded the superintendent certification.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so with the intent, did you have our local region in mind as well, just for the West Texas?
Yeah. I mean, I think people have said we're the only university within 250 miles.
That's right. Yeah. With UTEP West and UTPB.
So there's a lot of choices in higher education, especially being online. But when you look at those programs, and it's not disparaging any programs, but when you look at those programs, they're kind of traditionally oriented to these are the classes you take. You take ed law, you take, and those are still going to be some of the classes that we have to offer for certification for TEA purposes on the PK-12 side. But intentionally developing and weaving throughout a curriculum that is focused on those in this context, I think is what's going to separate us from others and really be a draw for students and send them out into the communities better ready to lead. Because you may go to an online program that's out of state or one that's across the state and you want to lead in, you know, Marathon, Texas or any of the communities that we serve, and you're getting a traditional curriculum and then you're having to synthesize that information and then apply it based on your local context. We want to address the local context in our curriculum so that you're learning on the fly, you're able to synthesize that in your coursework, and then when you walk into that first leadership position, you're more prepared to lead that context than you would be if you went to another university.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really cool.
Thanks.
So within that, with a lot of this preparation, I think, you know, the work that y'all do in education is just fantastic. I'm currently an MED student, and you know, from the coursework I've done, you know, coming from music to that, you know, I'm learning a lot. But one of the things, you know, and I'm sure you're asked about it a lot, everyone in the field's asked about it, just within the, you know, the landscape of teaching right now, it's just a war zone out there.
Yeah.
And so with having that built up sort of preparedness here, how do you foresee that, you know, going into that, the potential issue of a career field, of just the hours and the pay and this and that? Do you think it'll be a positive effect for those that are getting a master's or a doctorate here?
Yeah, I'm really thankful that she brought that piece up. I mean, what we hear in the news is accurate. It's a tough time to be an educator. There's a lot of burnout, a lot of turnover. As you know, the local educators, compared to a lot of educators in the state, don't get paid a lot of money. A lot of that's based on state funding models. And so it is a passion. It is, you know, you're going into it not to make money. You're going into it because it's a passion to serve kids and communities. One of the things that I've shifted my research towards in the later part of my years at the University of Houston at Baylor is health and well-being of educators and to prevention of burnout. So we are also going to embed in our curriculum how to take care of yourself and change organizational structures so they look at the employees as a whole person as opposed to just an employee that's there to teach, lead, and, you know, work 24/7. We want to help educators draw healthy boundaries for themselves and also push districts to change the way that they treat their educators and look at them as holistic human beings. I mean, I saw how hard my parents worked grading papers and how many hours they spent. I know how hard I worked as a teacher and principal. And I don't believe that you should have to choose between being a successful educator and being a healthy person.
Right.
And so I think you should be able to be a successful educator and a healthy person. It's not a binary choice and an either or. It should be an and. And so I think part of, you know, coming to a new university and getting to build that curriculum out is the opportunity to look at those types of conversations differently than our. I mean, there's some better research happening now around well-being and self-care for educators, but we're just getting started in that field. And nursing's done a better job. Military has done a good job. Social work, the field of social work, have looked at burnout of their employees, and education was kind of the last social science to start looking at that. We just, you know, you need to be superhuman.
Right.
You teach, you grade papers, you go to pep rallies, volleyball games, track meets, and you can never show weakness. You can never be vulnerable and show up and be healthy. And right. That's just not realistic for a human being. And so I think for us, having a chance to kind of think about what that looks like in the curriculum too will change the way that our future students that graduate from Sol Ross go into the field, and hopefully we kind of see a reverberation of what they learned here and then start to see districts change. And the more partnerships that we create with districts too, we can kind of work from the top down and the bottom up. That's the goal, right, is to create MOUs and close partnerships with our districts in this region and talk to them about, like, how do we improve teacher retention? How do we improve leadership retention? Here's some things that the research shows. Here are some good practices. And build that from the top down, and then have our graduates come out and kind of build that from the grassroots up. And so hopefully, you know, the goal is that after doing this for 5 to 10 years, you see a difference in the schools where there are Sol Ross people or Sol Ross partnerships. Mm-hmm. That's the goal.
Yeah. Do you think that there would also be a higher regard for, or maybe even just a way to reach out to people to see how, you know, the way that your dad always knew that you were going to be an educator.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, decades of teaching,
right,
there's people that you've come across as children or as adolescents or going up that you're like, you'd be a fantastic teacher.
Yeah.
Do you think that's an element that, you know, maybe our listeners who are not affiliated with Sol Ross,
sure,
may even sort of look into or ask about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that ties back into the social media piece. We need to show the joy and the visceral reward of being an educator, as opposed to hearing the stories online of burned out, stressed out. I mean, we need to show the other side of that. Not that stress isn't going to always be a part of the job, but there's a lot of joy and reward that comes from education, not just immediate joy, but sustainable joy if you look at communities that change because their school districts are thriving. And so the goal is to kind of convince people that education is a place worthy of looking for a profession. And, you know, for me, I'm an ed policy, my PhD is in ed policy. And so we have a responsibility too to push the state so that educators are seen as true professionals, compensated as true professionals, and taken care of at the state level. So the young, brilliant people think, well, I'd love to go in education, but I really don't want to make $34,000 my first year out of graduate school, you know. So we need to raise salaries. We need to improve working conditions so that people that are brilliant and want to be educators and see that desire to be connected with kids and communities will see education as a first alternative, as opposed to, you know, if I don't do this, this, and this, I can always be an educator.
Right.
We want people to seek education first, right, and the brilliance to go there as opposed to a fallback profession.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's so valuable too. Right. And, you know, there'll probably be less people visiting the very happy disciplinarian at their school who's like, come on, you do this. You know, it would be a huge turnover for a lot of students in,
yeah,
so many different areas. Yeah. Thank you so much for that insight.
Yeah.
Final question.
Yeah. All right.
So that was the hard question.
Okay. That was the
I spent all night to come up with. What advice do you have for our current Lobos right now?
Oh, I was just first of all, I got to say, one of the benefits of being the department chair is I get to teach the freshman seminar class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I love it. I never taught undergrad till I got to Sol Ross. I've always taught doctoral students and master's students. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe, you know, I have a kid that's a senior in college, one that's a sophomore in college, and I have a sophomore in high school, all girls. Mm. And so it's for me, I'm like giving back to where they're at currently and talking to my students like they're my own kids.
Yeah.
And so the advice I give to students at Sol Ross is to connect with others and to advocate for your needs. And what I was telling the freshman seminar yesterday, I said the difference between, one of the differences between higher ed and PK-12 is, you know, higher ed should be a service. All both PK-12 and higher ed should be about serving the needs of kids. But at higher ed, your student activity funds are paying salaries. So that people here at Sol Ross work for you.
Right.
That doesn't mean you have the right and responsibility to go up and say, you need to be doing this. I pay for your salary. Right. I told the kids, like, you know, but it does mean that you can, if you seek out adults and you seek them out in an affirmative way and with a positive approach, most adults at universities will go bend over backwards to help you navigate the complexities of higher ed.
Absolutely.
But kids don't always know that. I mean, we have a lot of first-generation students that maybe haven't been socialized to reach out to adults, or there's not a lack of, there may be a lack of trust. Mm-hmm. So I try to convince kids, like, if you look at student services, the different departments in the school, those are being paid for with your funds. They're here to serve you. Counseling is here to serve you.
Right.
Our nursing is here to help you be healthy. You know, their activities that are happening on campus are meant to engage you. So take advantage of all of those things that are happening. And if you have an issue that you're having difficulty with, instead of being frustrated with it behind the scenes, reach out to an adult, reach out to a faculty. I tell the students, you can reach out to me as a department chair. You can reach out to our dean. I don't know a person here. That's one of the things that makes Sol Ross special. If you come here, you can reach out to anybody.
Yep.
And they will lend a hand and help make sure that you're successful. So I think that service orientation of Sol Ross really provides an opportunity for students to not kind of suffer in silence and be stressed in silence.
Absolutely.
And the more that we can grow that culture here, the more successful our students are going to be. And that means our alumni network is going to grow and be more vibrant. And it's just going to be a positive kind of flywheel of momentum that we can build with service and taking care of our kids.
Absolutely. The longevity that comes behind that.
Yeah. And
yeah. You just have a better, like you were saying, on-campus culture.
Yeah. And
absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm a little biased, you know, I got my undergrad here.
Sure.
Transferred here from community college. And yeah. So it's all been very, you know, within arm's reach
right.
as far as getting contact with someone. But as you get older, talk to people who transferred here from larger universities, you know, other places, not so easy.
No.
You know, you're asking word of mouth most times. You're waiting for an email. Here, it's pretty quick. You know, we're down the hall. You know, you can just knock on the door. We're there.
At a lot of major universities, no matter what they say, you often become a number. And they're looking at your enrollment as tuition dollars and bring money into the university. And even though those universities have good intentions, you know, they don't have the capacity to serve that many students.
Right.
Sol Ross, I mean, we have the capacity to serve you individually. And so I tell our students, your family, I give them my cell phone number. I give them my Teams. I tell them, text me on Teams, send me an email. If I can't get an answer for you, I'll get somebody to get an answer for you. And so I think we have to capitalize. That's one of our strengths, is to continue to grow that family atmosphere. And I think you're going to see every year us become a more vibrant campus because word of mouth, alumni, et cetera, people say, I want what Sol Ross has. I want what those kids are talking about. And I think we're not a secret, but certainly there's a lot of opportunity for us to reach kids that maybe never considered Alpine, Texas, or Del Rio, or Eagle Pass for an education. So I think continuing in that model is going to help us grow.
Wonderful. That's a fantastic answer.
Thank you.
And we'll close. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you really for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Shameless plug.
Yeah.
Where can people reach you on Twitter?
On Twitter or X. It's Brad_Carpenter. And certainly you can just LinkedIn too. I have a really strong professional network on LinkedIn. And begrudgingly, when I got back to Sol Ross, I got back on Facebook, even though I got rid of it for a long time. I'm on Facebook too. So just Google Bradley Carpenter Facebook, Bradley Carpenter LinkedIn, and then Brad_Carpenter on Twitter. And I would love to add you to my growing education family.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll close with Go Lobos.
Go Lobos.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.